accession number 18835, Reel 2.
Jack Davis, Reel 2. Oh, what's happened there? Jack Davis, Reel 2. Jack Davis, Reel 2. Yes, so you were in the Sanctuary Wood area.
Yeah.
And going into the line.
I remained there with the battalion for 6 months in and out of the trenches in what was known near the Ypres salient, which meant it was crescent shaped. We, all our sections of action was on the inside. So consequently, we were under artillery fire, not only from the front, but being enfiladed both from left and right. And the communication trench ran in the Menin section, right from the Menin gate, ran a communication trench right to the front line. But, unfortunately, it was invariably full of water, or up to your fat thighs in water, so you had to scramble outside on no man's land, dodging shells. It was one like a cemetery or massive shell, where the only cover you had was in a shell hole. So whenever you walked, whenever you went up to the front line from the reserve trench or the in support line, it was always in and out dodging. They themselves were quite you couldn't use them then, because they too were mud and it was the most horrible, the worst sector in the whole of the war, that was. And we occupied all the sectors there from Meningate to Passchendaele, all the way through there. And I was detailed one night to go up in advance of the battalion to take over the officers' dugouts on the headquarters, signals, and all the principal dugouts before man in the front line. And I'm going up with the usual paraphernalia, pots, pans, and everything that I know for use up. I got within 15 yards of the front line, and you get the usual challenge, halt, who are you? And I thought, know that voice. My two brothers in the trenches, in the front line trench, a century ago, up to their thighs in water with a pair of long waders on. Can you imagine? I can't describe what I felt, really. But apparently, you see, they were working at the Junior Naval and Military Club in Piccadilly. And for some devious reason, whether there were a few strings pulled, because it's common knowledge, I suppose, to the other people that we work with, that a brother in Ypres. And that's how it happened. They got enlisted in the 7th and 8th Rifle Brigade. The Green Jackets, as we know today, with the black buttons and the green. And they, in turn, were their battalion joined my division, which was the 14th Division. I was the 43rd Brigade. They came out and joined the 42nd Brigade. So, for the next 6 months, we supported them. When they were in the front line, we were in support to them. When they came out, we moved in. So I used to meet them on the road going on. And being for some time with as an officer's servant and with headquarters, I'd contact with a lot of extra rations, you see, cigarettes and such, which incidentally I didn't smoke, and rations such as butter, jam, bread and all the rest of biscuits, whatever was needed in those days. So whenever we moved up, I always had a sandbag full of stuff and passed it over everywhere. And this went on right up until the Battle of Loos, when we acted as a decoy, thinking it was always a conversation between the other people there. Oh, going to straighten the line out today, going to blow Vimy Ridge up. And we fooled the Germans into believing that we were going to attack there. But consequently, prior to the Loos offensive, we were under constant bombardment day and night for nearly for 16 days. And to give you an idea of the severity of the artillery, the German artillery, they got all their crack Prussian guards in front of us and all the pick of the artillery right from the field guns right to the 15-inch. We lost nearly 200 men without moving out of the trench by the bombardment. That everything. And we were there. My two brothers, they were detailed to take two lines of trenches and retire as part of the decoy, while the Battle of Loos was a main offensive. And they went in 1,000 strong, their battalion, and came out less than 200. Oh, those casualties. They were moved back to a place behind the line in a place called Hookirk, which was about 14 kilometres behind the line. In between, on the main road, was a checkpoint of the Belgian and French frontier. There's always a guard there. We were there for the next 14 days before we were relieved. And the night we were relieved, it was wasn't only raining, it was teeming down. This is about between 8 and 10 o'clock at night. We were moved back between Ypres and Poperinge in the hop fields at Flamatinge. And we were told to make our bivouacs with our ground sheets. And you can imagine, after we had no sleep, no wash, nothing there, and with the rain pouring down, we were at a pretty low ebb. And I thought myself, my overriding thought was to find out what had happened to my two brothers. I didn't know if they'd been killed, wounded, or what. So, without any thought of the consequence about it, I thought myself, well, I might as well go and try and find them instead of getting soaking wet here. And believe me, I walked in the pouring rain over ploughed fields. I dared not take the main road because I would be caught at the checkpoint. I had to make a detour over plough fields, at the same time keep within distance and parallel with the main road, otherwise I wouldn't have found. I eventually found out where they were. They were billeted in army bell tents. And I found the tent where my younger brother was. And that particular time, they just had to post up for all the passers and home with only a handful of men to. And I stayed there for about an hour. My younger brother, he made me a cup of tea with what we used to call a brew up on a brazier. And while I was with him, I found out that my elder brother got wounded and was sent back. And while I was with him, with my other youngster, the company sergeant major came along and looked and wanted to know who I was. So he did want to know. They hadn't seen me. So I've got to get back. I've got to get back for rifle inspection in the morning. Well, I arrived there in the early hours of the morning and was immediately put in the guard room under guard. Up before the CO in the morning. And he read the riot act to me. He said, "You know what you've done?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well," he says, you've a choice." He said, "You can ask for a court martial or take my punishment." I said, "I'd rather take your punishment, sir." 3 days' pay stopped. That was my salvation, going, getting back. If I hadn't returned, that would have been desertion.
And you would have been shot, would you? Did you ever see any people shot?
I never saw them, but I knew how. I was once detailed, but didn't have to form the firing party. I missed it. You know, all through my army career, all through my war experience, I had a conviction that I would come through. And so, your main object, whatever action you're involved in, whatever the circumstances, your main consideration was self-preservation. And that served me in good stead. You see, because after the epicenter, we took over from the French at Arras, where the British extended the line and relieved the French in the trenches there prior to the first sub-offensive in early 16.
Before you tell me about that, could I ask you a little more about the Ypres area and the Battle of Loos?
Yes.
Yes. Did you experience any gas there?
Any
gas? Gas shells?
Oh, yes. I better come to that, you see. What actually happened there? On the first day of the summer offensive, I was at Delville Wood. That was the first of the summer offensive there. But there again, my lucky star or whatever it was, I went down with the trench fever with a temperature of 104. And I could hardly stand, let alone fight. So I was ordered to go make my own way down to the forward dressing station where the RAMC, where stretcher bearers are out gathering all the wounded. And we lost 50,000 men that day. And what happened all the way down behind the line? That was shelling with gas shells. Well, I can remember nothing at all about that. I must have caught a whiff of gas and collapsed. And my next recollection was being on a stretcher at the casualty clearing station. And I remained there, up and down, with the temperature rising, coming back again. And eventually they sent me to a hospital at Cabia on the coast, the hospital there. I was there for a fortnight, then sent back over to England. And being in London, they sent me to Newcastle. British paradise after that, well, really.
That Somme battle, you know, the opening stages that you, as you say, very narrowly missed through your trench fever. What did you see about the effects of that battle, the Somme battle?
Well, it's very difficult to sort of describe the emotion. I will say this, that all the thoughts and trepidation and all the rest of it before you went in, the thought of what you're going into. But once you go in, all that's gone. You're there to do a job when you've got yourself you've got to look after. That followed me all the way through my experience out there. That's what kept me going. For instance, you see, after a time, I joined the depot and went on a medical board and eventually marked fit after that. And I joined the 1st Battalion of the Duke Corps was a regular battalion. And I joined them at La Bassée. Well, we were operating not from a trench as such, but a forward area in what were termed saps. There were three saps. Suffolk sap, machine gun sap, and lunatic sap. I was with a section at Suffolk sap. And I was ordered to act as an orderly to my company officer, a certain Captain Taylor, who was a very fine officer and a fearless man. I had every confidence in him. And my duty was to accompany him to visit the other subs and take the rum ration out to them every night, which meant a tour of no man's land for a period between 3.5 to 4 hours. Then back again and rest in your dugout for the next day's duty, which you acted as a sort of liaison between all the other people. They'll take messages and see them report back to headquarters. The same again the following night. Well, during the operation that went on, I was detailed to accompany one of the new young officers. He'd never been on active service before, he comes straight out of, I should imagine, either Sandhurst or an officer's cadet force. He's detailed to join my battalion. And my company officer detailed me to take him out and show him where the next set was, and take the ration out, which I did, and brought him back. Well, you know, an officer is always trying to lead. You follow. Other ranks follow. Officer always lead. What he said to me the next night when we were due to go out again, all right, Davis, I'll take the lead. He did, on the German wire. And this is where I take charge. He didn't know what to do. So, you see, from the German machine gun post, when they can sight anybody out there, is traverse a machine gun all the way along. So what you've got to remember, I took refuge in a shell hole and beckoned the officer to come in as well because he didn't know what to do. And you see, when you're just below ground level out of machine gun fire, and as it passes over where you're, then you make your way back a few yards into the safety of the bombing post or machine gun post. So, quite successful. The next night, we're supposed to do. He said, to make sure, he said, we'll take Corporal Hardy from the machine gun post with us. And that chap had been there all the time that I'd been there. Same thing happened on the German wire. I went through the same procedure before. The corporal lost his head. Running backwards and forwards against by the German while he didn't, he lost himself. We got back. So I said, I said to the officer or the other people on the post, I said, we can't leave him out there, we've got to get him in. So we went back into the shell hole, and when he got within hearing this, he shouted to the major to come in to the shell hole with us. The same thing went on before. Oh no. But I led the way, officer followed me, and corporal was the last one to get in. We got in quite safely. And as the corporal went bending down to get into the trench, machine gun bullet caught him in the back. And there again, you see. He was lucky. It missed his spine by about 1/8 of an inch. It's only a flesh wound. I said, share my luck. I said, you're okay. Well, after he was dressed and all that, he was okay. But these things, you know, it is most important to have control of yourself. You see, other incidents where people don't take that reasonable care, they lose their life. You've got to be always looking after yourself, number one, as we call it. If you're unlucky, you're unlucky. But if you take the proper care of your own self, you miss an awful lot of danger.
So, when you went out again, this was at La Bassée, you say?
La Bassée. Mm,
La Bassée.
Mm. Where, you see, we were operating from these three saps here. The German communication trench led alongside or underneath the La Bassée Road there. Their communication trench there. Their front, German front line was at right angles. We were taken out of the line, and sent back while the other rest of the battalion was in the front line. We were planning to capture a German machine gun, which was causing a lot of trouble. And so we were taken out, and all the German line was taped out exactly in position that we were going to occupy.